Well, today is Declaration Day, the Declaration of Independence. The state that which gave us the most religious freedom was the state of Massachusetts. The state of Massachusetts is the home of most of the religious freedom, and guess who wanted that more than almost anybody? Sabbath keepers. Sabbath keepers. They came and formed the churches and were very happy to be in a country where their religious views were not persecuted, where they didn't have to pay taxes to support a state religion. They came to this country, Sabbath keepers. In the early days, of course, they were all British. And most all people came, and there were some Germans that came, different ones, but mostly they came from the British Isles and formed the 13, eventually it had to be 13 colonies. They were called colonies at that time because they were colonies. Each colony had its own little governmental structure, but they tended to band together to somewhat, but they were all subject to the British Empire, all the subjects of British. And many people make this mistake when they think of Paul Revere. They think Paul Revere rode through the streets of Boston yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming." He did not. He did not say the British were coming. He was British. All the people he's talking to were British. They were subject to the British Empire. He said, "The redcoats are coming. The redcoats are coming." Because the redcoats were the army that Britain sent to enforce different laws, because the people got to be very rebellious about those laws. They were unfair. They were taking things from the people. The king told the redcoats, the army here, live off the land. Go in and help yourself to the people's goods and come in. I want your cow here and kill it for me, and I want this steak and I want these chickens. And I want your milk here, and I want this. We're going to take it for sustenance for our army. You are subjects of the British Empire. And so that's what they did. And of course, as the colonies prospered, the taxes went up. Britain wanted more and more from the colonies. Give us these taxes. Support our armies. Support our things. And so the list of abuses just became enormous. From the Pilgrims' time in the 1600s, all the way now we're into the 1700s when these things began to rise in crescendo of the offenses, and the people were very upset. It continued to be until the people couldn't take it. And so you had, when we first came over here, the British peoples established a college connected to the churches. Churches for so long a time were the fundamental areas of learning. And why were churches learning? Because of a Bible. Because churches, Christianity, Judaism, were the people of the book. They studied the book. They studied and they read. They had to learn in order to have understanding of the scriptures. So they continued to read. So in America, the first college that was started was a little college called Harvard College. And people went there to learn. They learned on the British system. And here's the British system. Here's this book. You will memorize the pages from page 16 to 32. And on the Monday, everyone will recite the pages from 16 to 32. And so people came to school and could you memorize it? Yes. And you quoted, you memorized these pages. You memorized what this book said. You memorized what they said. Very strong teaching in language. Very strong teaching in arithmetic. You had to learn math, arithmetic. Everybody learned it. You learned how to spell. You learned how to spell. You learned how to speak. You learned how to grammar. You learned all these things. This was the English system. You memorized and you came in and repeated it. That was the English system of teaching. That lasted all through those times, all the way up into the 1800s. In the 1800s, some of the scholars, teachers, professors had toured Europe. And they went into Germany in the 1800s, went into German institutions of higher learning, and they were shocked, stunned. The professor didn't have them assign, didn't assign them out of a book all the time. The professor came in and he lectured. He told them what it was. They had a book that they read on in addition, but they didn't have to memorize anything and quote it. They listened to the professor who studied extra stuff and lectured them in this lecture. And they had what they call academic freedom. They had, in a sense, some tenure. The idea was the professor sought truth above all things, even if it went contrary to the church or the institution that founded the college. These were the German ways of teaching. Well, they came back from Germany and said, you know what, that's superior to the way we're doing it. We're just having people memorize certain parts of a book. You know, that's basically what we're having them do. So they went to lecturing. Scholars then studied extra things and brought in extra teaching. However, in 1776 and in the 1700s, people went to Harvard College. And Harvard College, as I said, there was one guy during those early times who got up in Harvard College, and he got expelled from Harvard College. His name was Amos Dunbar. He got up and he said, "The butter stinketh." And they threw him out. He was not allowed to attend Harvard College anymore. Now, his grandson did attend, however. His grandson became one of Harvard's most famous people. His name was Henry David Thoreau. And he wrote Walden and some of the other things. But Amos Dunbar, he was thrown out for such a rebellious statement as "the butter stinketh." John Adams was a graduate of Harvard College. John Adams was a farmer and also a lawyer. He was part of a group of people sent from various colonies that they established a Congress, representatives of the various colonies. By 1775, things had become so bad that gunshots broke out in Lexington and Concord. And also you had the fighting and the Battle of Bunker Hill. The war had actually started before the Declaration of Independence was ever done. We were already at war with Britain. The Minutemen were fighting them. Troops from Pennsylvania joined in to come to Boston and fight. Now, Pennsylvania was considered the Wild West. It was considered the Far West. In fact, John Adams' wife, Abigail, had never been out of Massachusetts. And when John Adams left to go to Philadelphia, where they were all going to meet to consider what we should do, the war is starting. The Congress of the colonies decided to have George Washington lead the armies. He would be the general of the armies. They sent him. Of course, he had defeat after defeat in the first parts. The British took over New York. The British, you know, they had the gunboats. John Adams' wife wrote to him and said, "We hear every day these gun cannons going off." She said, "It is very unnerving. It's very unnerving all day long. You know, you hear these guns and cannons." And he told her, "If they come down your way, run into the woods. Get safety in the woods." It was a difficult time. John Adams then had to make his trip from the Boston area to Philadelphia. Do you know what it was like to travel in those days? There weren't any highways, super highways. There were trails, little teeny roads. They were all dirt. You came over, and he had a horse. Sometimes pouring down rain. You know how it is in the Northeast. They have rains, and it's pouring down, and he's on he's got his stuff on to keep himself, from getting too wet. His horse is wet. The road is wet. It's muddy. He's coming along. It takes a couple of days, 2 or 3 days, to get from Boston to Philadelphia. There were no train tracks. There were no roads. There were no super highways. You just went the way the horse went, and that's it. And he made it to Philadelphia, where they decided, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We're already at war. How should we do this? Of course, they decided we need some form of declaration. We need some way in which we're going to say what should be done. John Adams was the prime mover. He was the shaker and the mover for the Declaration of Independence, pushing all of these various states and the representatives, pushing them to commit to doing it. I'll talk more about this after the special music.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with oil, God bless America, my
You know who wrote that song?
Irving Berlin,
a Jew who was happy to be in this country, like most Jews, away from persecution that they had found in Europe and other places. My home, sweet home, God bless America, because they had freedom from persecution, a place where they could be innovative, where they could make, money. We also sang Battle Hymn of the Republic. You remember the Battle Hymn of the Republic? There's no author to that. There's no composer. It was an old song that had been sung many times. And during the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln was standing there and the troops were marching by, they were singing this song, the same music, but they were singing filthy, dirty words to it. And one of the ladies, and I forgot what her name is, who composed the song, she said to Abraham Lincoln, the men are singing this song. That's all they sing, the same song over and over. It's filthy and it's dirty. They have all these dirty, ugly, nasty, immoral words to it. And she said, you know, can't we do something? And Abraham Lincoln turned to her and said, well, why don't you write new words to it? And so she composed then the words, what we now know as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. When they met, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, there were 56 of them from the representatives from the various colonies. You would think they just came in and it happened. Well, they had to argue and talk and negotiate. What are we going to do? Already in 1775, the war had broken out. They were shooting. There was shooting in wherever they could. And here came the redcoats, and they were going to put down any rebellions. But the people were sick and tired of being oppressed, and so they did rebel, and here came the redcoats. There were arguments over, what are we going to do? How are we going to what are we really going to fight Britain? Are we really going to try to do something else? And so John Adams was the number one spokesman. He pushed it hard. We need to do this. He was persuading everyone. He himself said, I talk too much. He said, I wish I didn't talk too much, but I do talk too much. And he was very outspoken, very, very vigorous. He was a short guy. Who is John Adams? He became the second president of the United States. He was short, about 5'7", stocky. Vigorous and strong to tell people, let's do this. Let's sign this Declaration of Independence. Let's declare our independence. Let's break away from Britain. Well, they have to consider it. When we sign this, you know, we're putting our names. They're going to come and find out where our farms are, where our address is, where we live. And that's going to put us in mortal danger. We are now going to be enemies of the state, enemies of Great Britain, and the Redcoats are going to try to seek us out. Now, you know that as soon as it was signed, many of them were not long to survive. Five of them were captured by the British and tortured before they died, and 12 had their homes burned from Rhode Island to Charleston, sacked and looted and occupied by the enemy and burned. So immediately, Great Britain struck at these people who signed this, what we call, declaration. They went back and forth on it. John Adams said, somebody said, well, John, why don't you write it? You know, and John Adams said, no, I don't want to write it because I'm too blunt. We need somebody that's got, you know, some finesse and some way of words and nicer and you know, much more gentlemanly. Let's bring in, you know, our friend and a member of the Congress, but he doesn't often attend. Let's get him down out of his place, his wonderful place down in Virginia. Let's get him out of Monticello and bring him here to Philadelphia. And so here came Thomas Jefferson. While John Adams was short and stocky, Thomas Jefferson was tall, lanky, thin. They said he looked marvelous on a horse. He could ride a horse really well. He was about 7 or 8 years younger than John Adams, and looked to John Adams as a mentor for the most part. Soft-spoken, you know, easygoing, just relaxed. And he was never fiery. He was very thoughtful about things. One of the things that John Adams had noticed about Thomas Jefferson was that Thomas Jefferson kept meticulous notes about all of his experiments. He loved to write experiments. And if you've ever been to, how many have ever been to Monticello? Ever been to seen his house? Well, if you go in, you'll see a big clock on the wall that Jefferson invented. He made it, showing the rising of the moons, made it to pick up the atmosphere, the, I mean, the the solar system, rising, the high moon, low moon. He figured all that out. It's incredible what he knew. And John, so much so that John F. Kennedy said, when he had his group of advisors, he said, this is probably the most intelligence that has ever been here and sitting in this White House, except when Thomas Jefferson was sitting here by himself. So they said, you know, you've got to write it. We have to find some way of writing this in a nice way, putting it out. He did so. He wrote long, long parts of it. The committee then accepted Thomas Jefferson to do so. After it was written, they sent it to Congress, to the rest of the committee, to edit it. They took out words here and words there, you know, that Thomas Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." That's what he put. They thought all of his writings were too wordy. Let's cut it down. So they changed it to, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." His original pen was, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Thomas Jefferson later commented that the Congress has mangled my treatise. They mangled it. But he went along with it because they all had to vote on it. So they did vote on it. They all came together. That it was, they declared themselves then to be independent and sovereign states, but united together. So it was called the United States. And when you referred to the country, you always referred to it in the plural. The United States are going to do this. These United States are going to do that. It was plurality of colonies and states. Each state was a separate sovereign, independent sovereign state with its own government and so on. And they were all declaring together that they were going to now be different and be no longer a part of the British Empire. They were going to be called the United States of America. They finally came to a resolution, and they pushed the independence, and it was unanimously approved on July 2nd, 1776. It was not announced until July 4th of 1776, but it already had been unanimously approved. The document had been completely done. Everything was finished on July 2nd. And for years, John Adams used to argue that the birth date of the United States of America should have been July 2nd. Not July 4th. July 4th was the day they announced it all, but it was not the day that it was finalized. Interestingly enough about the document, the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence, nowhere from the top of it to the bottom of it, uses the phrase Declaration of Independence. That phrase does not occur at all in that document or on the top of that document. We have put it on there, but it was never used. Now, did people call it the Declaration? Yeah, they did. They said it was a Declaration of Independence, but it was never used in that document itself. If you were to read the Declaration of Independence, I would say that most students, graduate students from high school, would be hard-pressed to understand a lot of the words, although they are not too bad, but the English is very well done. The words flow very well, and you would be well advised to read it out loud if you want to get a good idea of how to speak well and the words that come with it. This is how it is written. It goes, "In Congress, July 4th, 1776. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America." As I said, from 1776 until 1866, it was always the plural verb used with the United States. The United States are. The United States they will do. The United States we will do. Not United States it will do. It was never a plural. The United States is was not the statement. United States are, because it was the united, all these states. So the unanimous declaration, and they said it was unanimous, of the 13 states of the United States of America. And this is what they, how Thomas Jefferson and then those who edited it wrote. This is the preamble, it's called. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now they fought and argued over the phrase pursuit of what? Originally it was the pursuit of property. That was the original statement. The pursuit of property, of gain, that you could, you know, you had the right to life, you had the right to liberty, and the pursuit of, you know, of material gain and property. But they finally changed it to the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. What's a government for, as they viewed it? A government is for one reason, so that people can secure these rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You notice they didn't say life, liberty, and happiness. Because there's nobody can guarantee happiness. They can only guarantee that you're allowed to pursue it. Nobody can make you happy. You can pursue it. And sometimes you pursue it, and you don't always get happy. I don't know, I think it was Oscar Wilde that said this, but it may have been somebody else, one of the great quotes. There are two great tragedies in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it destroys your life, your liberty, and your pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such a form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Thomas Jefferson then wrote, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient reasons. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right them by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. And then he goes on to explain why. But in the long train of abuses, of usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, the people's right. It is their duty, he says, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which restrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, Let the facts be submitted in a candid world. So then they go on and list the list of abuses, what he has refused to do, what he did, well, how he's interfered with their taxes, how he's interfered with their laws, how he's interfered with their justice system, how he has just appointed people who don't know what they're doing over them and made their lives intolerable, how he has taken their property, how he has used it for their troops, how he has abused their powers, how they've just, you know, come in and with no regard to people. People's personal lives and property, just taken over their stuff. They've listed a whole list of abuses. This was the Declaration of Independence. Now, the men who signed that, the 56 men who signed it, were not doing badly under the king's system. They actually were doing very well. They had prospered. They were all fairly rich. Now, they may have been worried about losing their riches, but they were rich men. They were not poor men. They weren't saying, we don't have any food, we don't have any clothing. They all had houses and farms and barns and cattle and everything. They said, this isn't tolerable. We have to break it. They had signed the declaration saying, we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honors. Most of them gave every penny they had to the war effort. Most of them, almost every single one of them, died in poverty. Many of them died in diseases. July 4th is significant in other ways. You might not realize it, but yesterday was the 152nd anniversary of the winning of the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863. On July 4th, 1863, Robert E. Lee pulled his troops, the Army of Virginia, back out of Gettysburg and headed south, having suffered enormous 28,000 casualties his army suffered. In 3 days, July 1, July 2, and July 3 of 1863, his army was battered. His men, 28,000 of them, wounded, shot, dead, or missing in action. On the Union side, about 23,000 wounded, dead, missing in action. The fields around Gettysburg were literally strewn with bodies. So let me give you a little background. When the war broke out, you know, when the southern states decided we're going to be Confederate states, we're leaving the Union. Lincoln said, you can't leave the Union. And they did it. I mean, they were ready to go. And as soon as they knew where Lincoln stood on slavery, they knew where Lincoln stood on the Union, they knew, they said, oh no, he's going to start. And now we're, so as soon as Lincoln was inaugurated, bang, they declared virtually independence. They're leaving. And Lincoln says, you can't do that. You can't leave. We have a structure. We have a government. You can't leave it. You know, we are not going to be divided here. And so war broke out. The first thing Lincoln did was to go to Robert E. Lee. He said, would you command the Union forces and stop the rebellion? Lee said, I will, depending on where Virginia goes. But he said, I can never fight against my home state. Robert E. Lee ended up fighting for the South because Virginia voted to go with the Confederacy. So Robert E. Lee was they were happy to have him. Robert E. Lee commanding the Army of Virginia, commanding the southern states. He was the chief man for the general for their forces. And in the early days, one after another battle, the Union forces fell. Lee was so skilled in his military ability that he just took them back, and his men would just believed in him. If he said, charge, we can win, they charged with a confidence they could win. Battle after battle, the North was defeated. Meanwhile, the South thought the best way we can really get independence is if we can secure Europe's. So they sent ambassadors, people over to Britain. They sent them to France. They sent some to Germany. How about recognizing the Confederacy as a nation? If they could get Britain, France, Germany to recognize, and they had a lot of power because all these other countries used the cotton that came from the Confederacy, albeit by slavery. I mean, they got a lot of the stuff. We can sell this cotton. All these countries need our cotton in order to make their clothing and stuff. They had a reason to want, you know, to make the Confederacy live. Well, the Europeans, they say, well, you know, but we also trade with the North for other things. We don't want to make Lincoln upset. We don't want to make the Northern part upset. So we got to think this through. And so they were watching, is the South really gaining? And will the South actually get the victory? Lincoln was desperate. We need a victory. We need somebody to give us a victory in some of the battles. And just when about the time that the people in Europe were almost ready, here came the Battle of Antietam. The North won a decisive victory at the Battle of Antietam. The people in Europe said, well, we better wait. We're not going to be on anybody's side. We're not committed to anything. We better wait. We got to see here now. We thought it was going one way, but now the North won. Shortly after the Battle of Antietam, however, Lee's Army of Virginia won a major and decisive victory at Chancellorsville. And Lee was then up, you know, he was buoyed up now. Okay, man, we have got it in 1863. And so Lee says, let's move on. Let's take the army. He said, what we need now for the South, so that we can get these European nations on our side, what we need is to strike the North in the North. Going north of the Mason-Dixon line, which is, you know, the bottom of there of Pennsylvania. Let's go north into the Northern Territory and strike them. His army went up. He had his cavalry one place, he had the other place, and they, you know, it's a very complicated, if you've never seen the maps and all that, for the Battle of Gettysburg. And so they came up and they were in the fields outside of a little town of Gettysburg. Lee warned his people, no hurting of the civilian population. Don't touch the civilians. They're not in this. We'll battle. We're going to battle the Union forces. Lee was there. He had a general by the name of Longstreet. What should we do? Longstreet said, I think what we ought to do, now that they know we're up here, let's pull back until we get up on a hill south of Gettysburg. They know we're here. They're going to let them come and get us. We'll take the hill. Longstreet was a master of defensive military action. Lee said, that's sort of cowardly. We have to wait for them. We have to wait for them to come and get us. So he asked a few others, and they, I think we could get them. And so Lee says, we're on the charge. We could do this. We can get them. Well, guess what? The Union forces now occupied a hill. They were up on a hill. And it was now the Confederate forces that had to charge up the hill to win. Longstreet said, I don't think so. Lee said, will you do it? I'm giving the order. He said, well, you're the general. Whatever you say, you know, I'll do it. But he was half-hearted. He just could hardly stand it to send his men running up that hill. And these guys are up here, and they didn't know what forces. And forces came in. Other forces came in. A lot of heroic stuff happened on the Union side. They charged up the hill on the first day. They charged up the hill on July 2nd. They came back beaten. They were really bad. But Lee says, I think we could almost make it. We could almost pierce the lines if we go one more time. They did a third time, and they came back severely defeated. Now, they killed a lot of Union men. 50-some thousand people died. 51, 52, they think some close to 53,000 people either died, wounded, or missing. And many of them died. You know, when you got wounded in the Civil War, that the medical help was very bad. Gettysburg fields were strewn with bodies. Lee just was, he paused and he blamed himself. It's my fault. It's all my fault. I should have listened. I should have listened to Longstreet. Others can, because Lee had such a stature among the South, others blamed Longstreet. It's his fault. He wasn't enthusiastic. He didn't commit to it. He was dragging his feet instead of charging. So the Army of Virginia went south. It was such a turning point. It became the pivotal battle of the war that determined that the South lost so many people. Lee's army was so wounded, so hurt. Now, that didn't mean they stopped fighting. They fought for another 2 years before he surrendered at Appomattox. And it was July 4th, 1863, that they pulled away. Lincoln was informed. Lincoln was ecstatic. We held it. We won. We defeated Lee's army. It was unbelievable. It wasn't until November of 1863 that Abraham Lincoln traveled there. Lincoln came to Gettysburg. He was sitting on a train. I don't know what I'm going to say. And he penned the words. People thought he's going to make a really long speech, talk about it. He came there, and this was the speech. You can time it. Not very long. He stood up and said, 80 that's 87 years ago. That's 87 years ago. 1863 to 1776. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That's a direct reference to the Declaration of Independence. Now, he says, we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And finally, Lee was defeated, as you know. His army was tattered, he was broken, he was beaten. He tried one more time in 1865 there. He was, if we could just get the supplies, the supply lines, the North was now increasingly powerful, stopping the supply lines. There were battles in the ships off of the coast, and the North had put an embargo all the way from Virginia all the way around down to the Carolinas and all the way to the Keys of Florida, stopping, and all the way down through Louisiana, stopping ships from bringing in supplies for the South. It was major. The South was, you know, being struggled. Their currency was inflated. The Confederate dollar was worth virtually nothing. It's worth a lot today if you can get a Confederate dollar as a souvenir. But it was worth virtually nothing. And their economy was bad. I mean, they were really in bad shape. But Lee thought if we could just win against Grant. He knew Grant's army was there, but he needed supplies. His men were starving. They were without supplies. They just had no food. They were just weary. They came to one spot where they thought the supplies would be. They were going to send a train. It wasn't there. Lee said, "We can go on. It'll be in the next 20 miles. We can get 20 miles down the line. We can get it." You imagine walking 20 miles. And these men walked. And when they got there, close to Appomattox, it wasn't there. There was nothing. And so he said, "You know, we have to surrender." His men said, "Why don't we become guerrilla? Let's just do a guerrilla warfare. We'll just go off in little bands and do guerrilla warfare." And Lee said, "No. It'll disrupt everybody. It disrupts the citizens." He knew what happened in Missouri when you had all these guerrillas and you had these terrible things that happened to the people in Missouri. People were slaughtered everywhere. And these crazy people, the gangs, the younger gang, the James gang, the other gangs, even Bloody Bill, whatever his name was. I mean, they were just crazy people. And they loved to kill. He said, "No, we're going to surrender." If you read the documents and you read the civility, Grant writes him a letter, Lee writes him, Grant writes back, Grant signs his letter, "Your humble servant." They meet at Appomattox. Lee comes in. He is completely impeccable in his Southern uniform. Grant is slovenly. He's got dirt on his shoes. He's got his collar open. His thing is up. And as they meet at Appomattox, Grant says to him, "Do you remember me?" He said, "Yeah, I've seen you. They were both fought in the Mexican-American War down in Mexico. They knew each other." But Grant said, "You remember what you said to me back in Mexico?" They said, "No." He said, "You told me, straighten up, get your collar on, get yourself right in, and look sharp in your uniform." So now, here was Lee surrendering to the guy who was slovenly in his uniform and having to... And Lee says, "What do you want? What do you want from my men? What do you want us to do?" Grant said, "Have all your men march by. We have supplies. We have food for them. We have other stuff. We'll feed them, give them water, food, everything. Just have them march by and put their rifles here. Just lay all their weapons right here." Lee said, "What about some who have horses? What do they do if they have their own horse?" Grant said, "They can keep their horse." And he said, "Well, what should they do after they put their rifles here?" He said, "Well, just have a nice meal and tell them to just go home to their farms. Just become good citizens." He said, "Okay, that's good." So here they came, the Army of Virginia, tattered, skinny, thin. They fought valiantly for the South, but they've run out. It was all over. And they put their rifles on. And one of the lieutenants of the North told his soldiers who were standing out in front, "Attend, hut!" And they all saluted all these men who walked up and put their rifles down, saluting the Army of Virginia. Told them to go home. Just be good citizens. No rancor. We don't look at you as traitors. We're not making you, we're not punishing you. Just go home. Just become a good citizen. That move, and Grant knew Lincoln would approve of it, because Lincoln wanted union. Lincoln didn't want revenge. He wanted union. He wanted people to be together. He wanted the nation to stay as a whole. That was 1865. couple of years later, after the, of course, Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln fought for an amendment. He fought for that amendment to the Constitution, 14th Amendment, guaranteeing no slavery and everybody's free. Some years later after that, in Richmond, Virginia, there was a church, mostly attended by white people. But on this, I think it was Episcopalian church, and the pastor called for people to come forth. Come up and have communion. The first guy out of his chair was a black man. He jumps up and he runs and he kneels. Now, no black people have been in that church before. It was a white church. And all of a sudden, this black man comes up and he kneels right there, ready to take communion. The pastor doesn't know what to do. None of the white people have moved. Only this black man is kneeling. Finally, a man who, his looks were much older than his actual years, limping like, walked up to the front, kneeled beside the black man, and said, "I'll take communion with him." The man was Robert E. Lee, the general of the South. He kneeled beside the black man, and together they took communion. And after that, white people started coming up, and they kneeled. Lee was a leader of the South, and he was a leader of union, and he was an honorable man. My ancestors, bless them, I'm here because of them, but they would have never in their history put together a country like this. They would have never come to a place like this. And my grandfather left that area to come here because all he saw was fighting the Muslims every day, religious persecution and fighting. He said, I'm done. I want to come to a country where I can live in peace. God bless America.